Welcome to Making Waves, a show about sound art produced by New Adventures in Sound Art for WGXC Wavefarm and Beware the Radio. On today's show, we look back at the work of Susan Frickberg. She was a poet, composer, and spiritual thinker from New Zealand who passed away in April of 2023. She had a long history of activity in Canada, where she impacted the experimental sound communities in Toronto and Vancouver during the 1980s and 90s, before she eventually returned to New Zealand and then later Australia. In the second half of the show, we'll listen to a discussion that I had with two of Susan Frickberg's many Canadian colleagues, Tina Pearson and Jim Montgomery. But to begin, we'll listen to three pieces from her series, The Audio Birth Project. This radiophonic series of pieces are based on interviews that Susan did with her sister Margaret and her mother about their experiences and perspectives on giving birth. Susan responded to this interview material using a whole gamut of creative audio forms that ranged from abstract composition to sound poetry to spoken narrative to soundscape composition. And the works, along with others, appear on Susan's solo CD, Astonishing Sense, that's on the Earsay label from Vancouver. The first piece that we're going to hear is a three-minute radiophonic piece, Margaret, and that'll be followed by the eight-minute concert piece, Astonishing Sense of Being Taken Over by Something Far Greater Than Me, which is scored for violin and fixed media. And the violin is played by Nancy DeNovo, who commissioned the piece. That title is taken from a description by her sister, Margaret, which I think you hear also in the first piece when she gave birth to one of her sons. And her voice opens and closes this piece as well, and it appears at times very highly processed. The tape part contains granulated violin synthesized in natural sounds. And the work is based on moments of contraction and extension, mirrored by the violinist, who in performance alternates between playing and prayer. The third and final piece in this series is the six-minute I Don't Think Much About It, which was for violin and fixed media, and the piano part for that is played by Andrew Zink. So here's three pieces from the Audio Birth Project by Susan Frickberg.
I think there's a separation from the pregnancy. I mean, there's you pregnant. Now, that's a really rather grand and valiant time. I love being pregnant. I think I probably looked my best too. I never felt large or... I just felt fantastic. And I looked good. I know I looked good. But there's a separation from that, which is a state of self. You know, this wonderful Spanish galleon of self that is me pregnant, that I enjoyed greatly. I really enjoyed it. I felt wonderful. I felt sumptuous and beautiful. But that's all to do with self, you know, that's... And then there's this huge moving of worlds, and it's suddenly no longer you pregnant, but it's... It's the astonishing being there of someone utterly other. And the fact that person wasn't, I mean, couldn't have been without you, that simply didn't exist before you and suddenly was. Of course, it's complicatedly other than being pregnant, but it's so astonishingly other than being pregnant. It's not the same thing at all. In fact, the two have very little connection with each other. Well, connections. I mean, you can watch a child. I can't remember which one it was now, but I remember one of them moving in its sleep and thinking, that's exactly what it was doing inside me, and being quite moved by that. So there are the connections, But the sensations are utterly different. You know, the looking at a looking at a new baby is looking at someone. You know, that's not the same as admiring one's own flesh pregnant at all. It's someone other, someone wholly and completely other. I mean, it's just astonishing. At its own sort of pace from the very beginning. I mean, I remember it all being very, very much at its own sort of pace from the very beginning. I mean,
Thank you.
Astonishing things being taken over by something far above the moon. Astonishing things being taken over by something far above the moon. Astonishing things being taken over by something far above the moon. Astonishing things being taken over by something far above the moon. Astonishing things being taken over by something far above the moon. Astonishing things being taken over.
I didn't think very much about it, except in a sort of rosy way. You know, having children was seemed to be the whole point of being married. It followed just naturally. Pregnant quite by surprise. Never intended to get pregnant because we were still at university, and I knew absolutely nothing about it. About the afternoon, and I wasn't quite certain then, of course, what happened with pains, but we went into hospital about 10, and the Doug said, shall I stay? And the nurse said, no point, you go back to sleep, she won't be having a baby until tomorrow sometime, which rather shattered us all. When I think of pain, no, as pain it wasn't such, it was bloody uncomfortable. And really, very, very hard work. Very hard work. But the minute was over, that absolutely heavenly, euphoric sensation was just so wonderful. This baby in the bed next to me with her eyes wide open, rolling around all over the place. She's full of what they called butter. She was sort of greasy and very sort of white, but she was absolutely gorgeous.
This is Making Waves. I'm your host, Darren Copeland. You were just listening to three pieces by Susan Frickberg from her series The Audio Birth Project. That piece draws on interviews with the composer's sister and mother about the experience of giving birth. The Cut Common magazine in Australia published a tribute to Susan Frickberg that I'd like to quote from in part here. Frickberg created more than 80 works during her life, including musical, theatrical, and experimental sound works for cultural and religious settings. For her, music was an expression of her creative, intellectual, and spiritual life. She was involved in key experimental sound scenes wherever she lived. She passed away from a terminal illness in April 2023 amongst her family in Whanganui, New Zealand. She moved to Toronto in 1979, where she worked as a freelance composer, collaborating on the Structured Sound Synthesis project with Bill Buxton at the University of Toronto, also with the Canadian Electronic Ensemble and the composing collective Gang of Three. A key work from this period is her piece Transcendences from 1984. It's a 50-minute piece characterized by voices subjected to and augmented by a range of treated and synthesized sounds. These were sound worlds she would return to throughout her artistic life as she sought a way to address what it meant to be a human continually augmented by technology. Her theatrical work, Machine Woman, was also a seminal piece during this period as it combined electroacoustic music and radio art with performance art and street theater. In 1986, she moved to Vancouver, where she completed a master's in electroacoustic composition at Simon Fraser University and later taught acoustic ecology there for several years, immersing herself in what was the center of soundscape studies at the time, working alongside Hildegard Westerkamp and Barry Truax. This period would profoundly influence her approach to composition and life thereafter, and she remained in close contact with her colleagues after she moved back to New Zealand in 1998. There in New Zealand, she undertook studies in classics and theology at the University of Otago, and a five-year hiatus from composing ended in 2002 with her notated a cappella vocal work, Virgin Mother. She moved to Melbourne in around 2014. For the second half of this show, I'd like to look back at a period of Susan's life when she was active in the experimental sound scenes in Toronto and also in Vancouver. And for that, I'm going to share my conversation with Tina Pearson and Jim Montgomery, who knew her through that period and remained up to her passing and to be one of her closest friends. My conversation with them captured the spirit of her, Susan Frickberg, as a person, as well as some of the underlying motivations behind her creative work. Any initial memories that came to mind when I first, invited you to join me today?
I had a really, what I considered to be a close relationship with Susan. I considered her a very good friend. She was a large personality, and very warm, very accepting. I don't think I ever saw her do, I never saw her do a mean thing in all the time I knew her. I met her at the Structured Sound Synthesis project that Buxton was running at U of T, which was a computer-based back in the day with DAX, and it was, relatively primitive state of computer music at that time. We did several collaborative compositions as part of the project. I listened to one of them the other day. They weren't very good, but that was mostly the limitations of the system. The system had a very, very limited textural color, timbre possibilities, which Susan was pointed out quite vociferously several times to the people who were running the project, because that they weren't really interested in the music. They were more interested in the interface, the user interface that they were developing. So there were some rather heated discussions about the lack of development of the timbral qualities of the system. But they were fun, and that project had several long lasting effects. The work that they did with the interfaces actually still can be considered relevant. Mm. And she was a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, Jim worked a lot more closely with Susan than in terms of creative projects. I think my relationship with her was, I guess, maybe three things. One was just as a friend, and her... I mean, I'll agree with Jim here. I mean, Susan did not do anything halfway, and she was so kind and thoughtful in a feisty way. You know, it was such so big. Yeah, big is a good word for it. And then also with Music Works, she and I talked about that a lot. And you know, back then in Toronto, you know, it was a man's world. So, you know, this was kind of part of an ongoing discussion we always had about the difficulties we each faced, the challenges. There was a women's issue of Music Works that she had I'm pretty sure she wrote something, and maybe she was involved also. I think her and I and Gail Young and I think Linda Smith and a couple of other people interviewed Anne Southam all together. And that was really illuminating, actually. And Susan was, I guess, one of my closest sort of confidential advisors for that time with Music Works. And she was, the other part was just her way of how she dealt with being a mother in difficult circumstances, from being pregnant, you know, through giving birth and then mothering Esha, and how that it was like she was such a whole earthy whole person, you know, that mothering just, you know, it entered her work in a really good way. So, and she was quite supportive of me as a mother, but also as a woman who was a composer and a creator and a mother at the same time. And I also became a solo parent. So she was just incredibly influential for me in that way, very supportive. And, you know, we talked a lot about how our bodies influence our music, how our bodies, the earthiness of the body and what the body goes through, and those experiences that are different for women and men. And that was really quite, there's not many women that can talk about that. That there's a, you know, I guess, I don't know if I'm betraying womanhood here, but there's a difficulty with women who are involved in music, especially, which is still a man's world, in actually being open about how our bodies influence our work. And Susan had no fear about that whatsoever. You know, I think that fearlessness was really there for her. And the other, still in Toronto, she, I don't know if she started this gym, but there was this composers forum for a while that happened at the CEE studios, I think, sometimes, and sometimes maybe at the Music Gallery. Were you involved in that? I think she started that.
Yeah,
and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
So she was so interested in just, like, let's talk about stuff. Let's do music. Let's support each other. Just so open. And that wasn't very common in Toronto at the time. You know, there was a lot of protectiveness. So it was quite amazing to have this group where people could bring their scores and get feedback and talk about, you know, what we were working on. And she was quite a, she was just so supportive of that kind of dialogue among composers for technical, like, you know, what you're working on technically, thematically, dealing with musicians, you know.
I can't remember where exactly this happened, but it led to this, series of listening evenings. Actually, they went all night. Basically we got, I think it might have been at the Music Gallery on St. Patrick.
Yeah, I remember this.
But, yeah. We got a bunch of beanbag chairs and put them on the floor, and people listened to, people would just put on their tapes and they just ran all night, right? It had a limited audience because a lot of people couldn't stay up all night, but it was, that was Susan. Do it full bore and just go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. That definitely was, you know, Susan really, really so fearless.
She had a really great relationship with the outdoors, with the outside, our place is rural. And the first night she came up there, she was determined that she was going to sleep outside. We had a hammock hung up out between a couple of trees, and it was like late June, and the mosquitoes are just, you know, they're fierce.
Yeah.
So she was undeterred. So she was determined to stay in that hammock all night long, and she did. Right? She was eaten alive, but she actually. You wouldn't give in. So I don't know. I think that there's a real, when you met her, there was a real groundedness about her. You know, you knew right away that you were dealing with somebody right up front, and her feet were on the ground, and she was connected.
Yeah.
And she was just inviting you to participate in that same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when you're working with technology, And electronics, there can be, to be really, really clean with it, you know, to really get into the technology of it for the interest of that. Like, I mean, for me, it's Beat Phenomena. I mean, I love, you know, and it seemed to me that for Susan, technology was a tool, and her, she didn't succumb to letting that determine how she made her work. Her work still embodied that, you know, the kind of unpredictability, sometimes the chaos or the messiness or the, you know, of living systems with technology. And that I really appreciated that about her work. It was always her, it was identifiable as her work.
Yeah, I think that's really true. In the sound synthesis stuff, I remember we were working one night and, there were artifacts that were being produced by the DAX. They weren't exactly aligned, right? And, she just decided that, that was the piece. I mean, it wasn't a flaw. Yeah. It was a feature.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like what's life presenting you with? What is this, you know, kind of crazy thing of all this technology? What's it presenting you with? You know, I mean, they're kind of, you know, all of these systems, you know, synthesizer systems and electronic systems, and they're kind of haphazard, depending on who makes them, what they have at the time. So, you know, I really loved how she embraced it for what it was.
Well, I was thinking about what Tina said earlier, about it being a man, about it being a man's field, a man's, domain of, technical music. And I will say that there were men who will remain nameless who actually stood in her way. Made it difficult for her to do things because she wouldn't follow the orthodoxy of the time, right? She didn't care about whether it came up to spec or not, right? As long as what the result was what she wanted, right? So it's, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that feistiness became even more honed and strong when she was resisted and challenged, which she was. You know, it really was difficult. It still is. You know, I think it's you know, there's still issues. I think it's better, definitely, for women, non-male identified people to work in with technology. You know, at the time when we were in, I'm talking mainly about being in Toronto, it really was pretty mean. And there was a lot of that, not acceptance or, you know, a famous late composer who's a woman, was at, in Vancouver, there was a residency that I was part of in Hildy, and Susan came and visited, the residency. And she was talking about working with technology, and a couple of women this was when the first, this was like maybe 88 or something, when the first big Emu samplers came out, those big, huge things. And so she was commissioned to make a piece for that. And you know, the women, we were, there's about maybe seven or eight of us standing around talking with her, and some of the other women were really amazed that she could, you know, handle this technology so quickly, and how amazing it was that she knew how to manage this technology and take all these samples and do all this really complicated work with this sampler. She said, "Oh, I'm not doing it. I have the ideas, but these guys do it." And, you know, the guys who know about it do it, because how it works, you know, in my career, what I've learned is that all of us can be standing around in a circle, sharing and talking about the technology, sharing information, But what's really happening is that the men are actually passing the real information behind their backs to each other and not sharing it. And we all kind of looked and thought, yeah. You know, and I'm sure sometimes maybe it isn't unconscious. Maybe, you know, I know Susan certainly ran into that. Jim, I remember some of those stories, and I certainly ran into it where it was blatant, like, okay, this is intentional. But sometimes I think it's just an unconscious, you know, it's how you're trained to do things. You're trained to do things as a network of men. That's just how it is. And so you have this language, and that's how you work, and that's what happens. And I think that, you know, being restricted either blatantly or by that kind of thing, you need to change how you're working. You need to alter your expectations. And I think all of us deal with it in different ways. And Susan just pushed back harder, I think, a lot of ways. And I think also she was prevented from doing some pretty amazing things that she probably could have done had she not been, you know, treated sometimes not so well. Yeah. I mean, she was really a brilliant, amazing creative force, and that's really threatening to people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there were, I mean, like, you know, just to be, you know, to be balanced about this. So yeah, that existed for sure. And despite all of that, she was able to do some pretty incredible things that were generous. I mean, she was so generous with, you know, setting up some of these things we talked about, and with her time, and again with her friendship.
I was thinking of her project, Machine Woman.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that represented some of that kind of fearlessness that we were talking about. And I was wondering if either of you had any anecdotes about that project.
I mean, it was a real labor of love for her, that project. But I wasn't involved in it either. I think it would be really good to talk to someone who was more intricately and intimately involved in that project, for sure, because it was a fascinating piece.
I remember the performance, which was very, it was Monique Mohija,
yeah.
I think is how you pronounce her name. An indigenous performer, dancer, incredible, powerful performer. And Susan just, you know, it was like she found she found another voice. It was really, I mean, the I can't remember whether it ran or whether how many performances it actually had, but the one I saw was in the afternoon, and it was open air. There were no tickets or seats, or any, it was just an open air performance that started. It was down at Harborfront, and the people who were the people who were already at Harborfront, mm-hmm. wandering by. And it was kind of like a busker show, but by the end of that show, there must've been 500 people, you
yeah.
know, they're just absolutely mesmerized. It was, yeah. That was really good.
Brilliant. It was brilliant. I mean, in some ways, maybe it was her way of, you know, pushing outside of the boxes of electronic music. I don't know if it was intentional, but it seemed like it was, you could kind of say it was Susan's way of just pushing outside of that box and just doing her thing, you know, because it was such a Susan, yeah. It was so Susan, this piece. I wonder if there's any video documentation of it.
I have no idea, but I know that a whole lot of that stuff just didn't get documented at all, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah.
The ephemeralness of it all. But I don't think that bothered her. I mean, she was really about the piece in the moment and what was happening with the people who were watching the piece, the organic occasion, what was going on, how the process went.
Yeah, and maybe her personalizing technology, I think, with that piece. I mean, that piece involved the ideas of birth, of, you know, there was so much Susan's story inside the piece, like directly,
We were trying to work with her before she passed, and trying to get a performer up in Northern Ontario that could play her the violin piece from her audio birth project, the one that Nancy DeNovo played, and she was it was interesting for her. What mattered, it seemed, at this time, was that it wasn't so much the virtuosity of the player, but that they was more the commitment to the subject. And it seemed to be that working with the life of the performer and the things that are behind the notes was seemed important to her. And I kind of, when you were talking about Machine Woman in that way, with it seemed to convey that sense that I encountered with what we were trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me, in that I think what Jim was saying about working in the moment and working with what was there and not getting distracted by ambition or a specific outcome, but working with inside the process and who's there, what the materials are, the materiality of all of it, you know, the content, the messiness of it, whatever it is. And then, you know, having this attitude of complete acceptance and compassion, and that we can make beauty from that, whatever it is, you know, it just seemed to be what she embodied.
Were there any experiences in Vancouver, Tina, that you'd want to add, that, you know, because you also knew her later on when she was on the West Coast, and
I did,
and how that
but
differed from her time in Toronto?
I did, but I've never lived in Vancouver, just for like 6 months when Hildy was in India and I lived at her house. But so when I was living in northern BC, you know, like a 15-hour drive from Vancouver, so I wasn't there that much. And you know, when we visited, for sure I visited with her, and she came up and visited. She came up, I think her and Esha came up a couple of Christmases. We had them up, so Susan could experience, they could experience freezing cold and snow, 40 below weather. The outdoors part didn't quite come through there. I mean, you know, that's when the time too is when her life really took a change, and she really went full bore into theology, and decided to, you know, as you probably both know, go back to school and get her master's, and I think it was a theology. So she really pulled back from composition and music. For me, my relationship with her that during that time was kind of a continuation of from Toronto, and was focused more on our kids, and again our kids, with being women who wanted to do, women who were independent and who wanted to do something and had kids. And so she was, you know, and again in Vancouver, one thing I do know, she there was this attempt to get, I can't remember now what it was, but there was some kind of forum like thing kind of happening, and you know, and again Susan was advocating fiercely for women to be there, and that if there wasn't childcare, how could the women come, right? And you know, this kind of thing you don't think about, because the people who typically come to these things are men or women who have husbands. And so Susan couldn't go because she wouldn't have had childcare. You know, so this kind of thing, the stuff of life that comes into our work as artists and composers, you know, she was just fierce about that. And was really quite really fierce with me about, no, you can't quit doing music just because you you have a child, you know. So she really, like, that just was part of her, and that core of her just kept going, that kind of fire for anything that was related to kind of social justice. Yeah,
I remember the last time I saw her, she'd come back to Toronto for, we were trying to get put a project together that would justify her coming, her travel to come and stay in Toronto for the duration of the project. And well, it's one of those times when we ran into some resistance, and the project never happened. Well, she told me about her. I can't call it a conversion. It wasn't, but her commitment to us, to this spiritual life, right? Mm-hmm. And I was nonplussed, let's say, by this turn of events. We had a long conversation about a very basic conversation about how one lives a spiritual life. What does that mean? How is that manifest? And she was, as she always was, unreservedly committed. I'm struggling for the right words. I don't want to turn this to a hackneyed description of someone who finds Jesus at the end.
Yeah.
But it was totally sincere, totally full. I mean, I consider myself a spiritual person, but my spirituality is not reflected by any of the Orthodox religions that are currently, that people, when people talk about Islam or Judaism or Christianity, that's not where my spirituality lies. And a lot of our conversation had to do with why that was the case, and why hers did. She had found a home. It was one of the great conversations I've had in my life. I already knew that she was a generous, warm, wonderful human being. This sort of took it to another level. In the time of her life that was left after that discussion, it became ever more clear that she was living a life of service. It was very moving. It was completely Susan. Consistently Susan.
Yeah.
That was Tina Pearson and Jim Montgomery in conversation with me, Darren Copeland, about the life and work of Susan Frickberg, who was featured on today's edition of Making Waves. We began the show listening to her radiophonic series of pieces, The Audio Birth Project. Those pieces can be found on the Earsay label on Susan Frickberg's solo CD, Astonishing Sense. Thanks for listening. Join us 1 month from now for another episode of Making Waves.
Thank you.